The Future of the United States Supreme Court. Justice Antonin Scalia's unexpected death earlier this month set off a storm of strategizing, statements, and speculation. President Obama says he will appoint a successor, but Senate Republicans say they will not hold a hearing until after a new president is elected. Democrats are calling the Republicans obstructionist. Republicans are calling the president a lame duck. And there are many questions, including how the Supreme Court might function with only 8 justices and what this battle means for the presidential race. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with 3 constitutional scholars about this historic situation. What does the Constitution say about the appointment of a successor? What are the implications of not confirming a new justice right away? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. After the unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the scrambling began. Should President Obama nominate Justice Scalia's replacement? Who is on the short list to fill that vacancy? Now, Senate Republicans say they won't even hold a hearing if the president does put forward a nominee. The president says, yes, he will. The future balance of our nation's top court is a topic of hot debate on Capitol Hill and here in Maine. With me in the studio to discuss this, Jeannie Hay. She's University of New England's Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Dimitri Bam is a professor at the University of Maine School of Law. He teaches and writes in the fields of constitutional law and the judiciary. And joining us on the line from Waterville, Joseph Reisert. He's the Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law at Colby College. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. How should the next Supreme Court justice be chosen? How do you think the changes might be felt here in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dimitri Bam, put this into some historic perspective for us. Characterize the importance of what's unfolding around the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, this is a big seat to fill. So the court has, you know, in my lifetime, has been a more conservative court since the early 1970s. It's been a kind of a more Republican-appointed judges. So it becomes a very important seat, which is why we're seeing all this rancor, right? Because it's a court seat that'll define the direction of the court for many years to come. And so while you've seen, you know, important nominations, important hearings, this is one that will make a big difference for generations on many important issues.
Jeannie Hay, what's at stake? Obviously, the balance between liberals and conservatives. But I'm wondering what else you're watching. Are there potential cases that are in the pipeline that this really matters?
Absolutely. There are cases that are on the docket to be in the coming Supreme Court term that involve very important issues, as bombastic or explosive as things like abortion, affirmative action, union rights, and other things. And the fact, as Dimitri said, that this is a very important seat. You know, the court has been for a long time essentially 4+4+1, where we had the reliable conservatives, the fairly reliable Democratic or left-leaning justices, and then Anthony Kennedy, who was considered the swing vote, who sometimes would go would more typically conservative, but not always reliably. So now we've lost one of the two most conservative voices on that in Antonin Scalia, a very decisive vote against abortion, for example, against affirmative action and other things. So so now we're in a 4-4 potential situation, and these are issues that are very critical to our daily lives and our national political life as well.
Joseph Reisert, no matter who's nominated and whether they're nominated next week or next year, can you talk about what the court will be like without Antonin Scalia? I understand he was such a big personality on the court, and for more than just how he voted and what he wrote.
Well, it's clear that his fellow justices will, I'm sure, personally miss him acutely. He was very close, interestingly, with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, even though they're at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. So there's that personal loss. But intellectually, Scalia was in many ways the most vocal and articulate, consistent and vigorous defender of a certain kind of jurisprudential outlook. And without Scalia there, I guess the interesting question is whether that role will fall maybe to Justice Alito. Will he try to become that kind of intellectual leader, or will really the conservatives be leaderless?
I'm wondering about what's going on right now. The announcement that was made yesterday that the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Republicans say, we're not even going to hold hearings. Do you all think that that's a threat, or that's really going to happen?
It sounds to me like it's really going to happen. Almost before Justice Scalia's body was cold, the Republicans came out and said the president shouldn't nominate a new justice, and we won't be willing to confirm anybody. There was some backtrack then within the last week or so, but yesterday Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans really doubled down and said, not only are we not willing to hold hearings, we're not even willing to meet with any potential nominee, for a sit-down or a dinner. Bless her heart, Susan Collins is one of two of the Senate Republicans who are not taking that position and are saying that that we should look at any nominees and give them a fair hearing. But just this morning on NPR, Senator Amy Klobuchar was interviewed on this, and she's, clearly strongly in favor of having a nominee be vetted and have hearings. But the best she could do is say something along the lines of, I really hope Mitch McConnell does the right thing and changes his mind, and I wouldn't hold our breath on that one.
We reached out to Senator Collins this morning to see if she wanted to call into the program, and she can't because she's actually in a vote right now. But they did send a statement, and here's a part of it. I'll read part of it. As with all judicial nominees, but especially for a Supreme Court justice, I consider carefully the nominee's intellect, integrity, qualifications, experience, temperament, and respect for the Constitution and the rule of law. This is the approach I've taken with every judicial nominee who's come before me. She goes on to say, I believe that we should follow the regular order in this process and take this process one step at a time, as we always do under the regular order. I would expect that there would be a hearing on a nominee if one is set forth for our consideration. So she's not encouraging the president to nominate someone, but she is saying, if he does and there is a hearing, I will be fair.
Yeah, I mean, I do take the threat seriously, and I think it's likely that they'll probably try to hold off the hearings as long as possible. On the other hand, the most recent polling numbers show that about 56% of the public supports having a hearing, and so I think if those numbers hold up or get even stronger, if the Democrats see even more stronger support once there's a name and a face in front of the people, the Republicans might change their mind. I mean, there's political expediency as well. And so if you're seeing opposition to your position to holding off the hearings and you think it might be expedient to at least hold a hearing.
Given that, Dimitri, I wonder, were you surprised at that letter that the Senate Republicans sent yesterday?
Not really. No.
But won't it be politically difficult for them to change their mind after something like that?
I mean, I think they've, like you said, within hours of Justice Scalia's death, they've made their views clear. I think you can always say, well, once you see the person nominated, well, we believe Justice President Obama nominated somebody who's very reasonable, and this has sort of changed our view.
Joe Reiser, we have an email from Scott. He writes, the U.S. Senate needs to ask what Scalia, a constitutionalist, says about the nomination process. He'd probably tell the Senate to do his job. Do you agree with Scott?
Interesting.
Well, of course the Senate should do their job, but part of their job might well be to decide not to hold a vote this year. I mean, it's interesting. We've characterized the Senate's letter as involving a threat not to hold hearings. If one viewed it favorably, one would construe it as a promise. To the core Republican constituencies, it's important that the president's choice not be confirmed. And, I think in in all sincerity, most of the Republicans who now don't want to hold a confirmation hearing believe that that's actually the better course for the good of the country. Now, obviously, we dispute that. That's why we have two political parties and people get to vote for whom they want. But, you know, there is a sense in which the choice not to confirm is a choice, and it's a choice they're making in full view of the various consequences, you know, that they'll face for it.
I wonder, I mean, what you just said, it makes total sense, but I wonder what kind of new precedent that would be setting. A lot of the coverage about this lately has been talking about, you know, should Obama do a lame duck nomination? And it seems to me that 10 or 11 months before his term is over, that's a pretty broad definition of lame duck. I usually think of lame duck as, you know, when you're president after your successor has already been elected. So we're talking essentially early November through January 2nd. So, or January 20th, excuse me. So I just wonder if, you know, what if Hillary Clinton is elected and but the Senate stays in Republican hands? You know, 2 years before a reelection, would they say, well, you're a lame duck now and we have to wait? I think it's a hard case for the Republicans to make. But as you say, Joe, because the partisans don't want an Obama nominee, they may get away with it.
Who do you think the president will nominate? And what is some of the thinking going on? What I've read is the thinking is nominate someone who's already come before the Senate and somebody who's been nominated or passed even unanimously, or should it be someone who would really change the tenor of the court? You know, what do you all think is going to happen? Joe, I'll send this to you.
Well, the first thing is, as long as he nominates someone who is to the left, say, of Anthony Kennedy, right, that immediately shifts the center of gravity on the court dramatically. So you don't have to appoint an exceptionally liberal person to really move the center of gravity a good deal. I think he's got really a difficult choice to make. You know, on the one hand, the president's only going to get the nominee through if the Democrats generally are able to raise the political heat enough on the Republicans to make it untenable for them to refuse to hold hearings and a vote. And so that would suggest finding a sort of appealing, maybe somebody on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals who's maybe got some, you know, first of an ethnic group kind of, you know, sexiness to it. You know, or conversely, the president might want to charge up the Democratic electorate base by finding somebody who's a really staunch figure on the left who will be, you know, really energizing and exciting. And I think that's an important tactical decision that has to be made.
Yeah, I think Joe is right. I mean, I think there's a strategic choice you have to make here. Do you nominate somebody who will kind of embarrass the Republicans more, having just confirmed, you know, somebody like Srinivasan 97-0 just a few years back? Now maybe looks worse not to appoint them, versus somebody who might kind of really energize more of the left wing. Maybe something like Loretta Lynch, you know, sort of bring her out and kind of energize the African American vote and more of the left wing vote that you know she's being stalled, and maybe you know, be a racist part of the conversation as well.
I would very much predict the embarrassment option that you just said. In other words, Obama has a number of possibilities. Sri Srinivasan is just one of them, of people who, as you said, Jennifer, were already strongly supported by the Senate when they went to the appeals court and who don't have reputations as raging liberals, but rather as, you know, reasonable people on the judiciary who you know are either moderate or respectful of precedent and everything else. When Obama does that, he puts the political heat on the Republicans in a way that if he puts out a Loretta Lynch or somebody, let's just say if he put out the Scalia version of the left, that would be bad, I think, for him, for his legacy. It would go nowhere. It would embolden the candidates in the Republican presidential election right now, and that person would have absolutely no chance of getting confirmed. I mean, to get confirmed in the Supreme Court right now, you have to thread a needle thinner than any we've ever seen in history. So I think he goes with the embarrassment factor, but it may still not work given what the Republicans said yesterday. We're not even willing to sit down with them.
If you're a candidate and you get the call from the White House, do you say yes? Do you accept, or do you say no thank you, I'll wait? Joe,
that's a great question. I think it'd be very hard to turn it down. I mean, the opportunity comes probably once in a lifetime. On the other hand, the actual burdens on you as a nominee are very large, right? You have to stop taking new cases. You have to cease being involved in the operations of your law firm. Now, I guess it's different if you're already a federal judge. They don't have to just drop everything. But if you were in private practice, say, it would be hugely burdensome.
I have a question that I think Joe and Dimitri are in a better position than I to answer. If the president nominates somebody now and the Senate goes through with saying we refuse to hold hearings, so that nomination dies, but you nonetheless get an enormous amount of scrutiny in the media and in government, is there a scenario under which a future Democratic president could nominate the same person, or is that considered, done goods?
There's nothing against that as a rule, and I think some person could be nominated. It would really depend on why the nomination failed. I mean, if you see sort of the Bork scenario, then I think that person could not be nominated.
No, I'm saying assuming they refuse to hold hearings.
Yeah, I think the same person could be nominated. And in fact, I think President Obama could use it as kind of a threat. Like if the numbers starting to look like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, the next president, then maybe my more reasonable choice is better for you guys than what's going to happen down the line, which is another reason why Republicans might change their mind. If the polling starts showing you're going to have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, then you have much more power now to try to get the candidate you want than you will in 12 months.
Well, then my answer to your question then, Jennifer, if I got that call and, assuming I have no skeletons in my closet, which of course I don't, I would say yes, because I get to kind of play the martyr for the rest of this year and gain some points that way. And then, assuming a Democratic president were elected, I could then sail in under a Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders nomination.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Central Maine Healthcare, working with the Mass General Cancer Center to connect Mainers to world-class cancer care, cmmccancercare.org, and Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint, Casella, giving resources new life.
Joe R. Lansdale is the award-winning author of the popular Happ and Leonard Mysteries, the basis for a new series on the Sundance Channel. On the next Fresh Air, Lansdale tells us about growing up poor in Texas in the 50s and becoming a writer.
I wrote one short story every day for 90 days, and they were all awful.
He got better. His new book is Honky Tonk Samurai. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. You're interested in what's going on around the world, in our country, and right here in Maine. That's one reason you listen to public radio. But sometimes you'd like to focus just on Maine, and that's why Maine Public Radio offers This Day in Maine. A daily online summary of all the day's Maine news, This Day in Maine, is available each weekday evening at about 7 o'clock. You can listen right then, or take it with you whenever and wherever you'd like as a podcast. The day's Maine news, This Day in Maine, in the iTunes Store or at mpbn.net.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what happens in the future in the absence of Justice Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court? With me in our studio, Jeannie Hay. She is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England. Dimitri Bam is a University of Maine Law School professor with a focus on constitutional and judiciary issues. And joining us on the line, Joe Reisert, Colby College Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now by phone, political science professor at USM, Ron Schmidt. Ron, thanks so much for calling in.
My pleasure, Jennifer.
I wanted to bring the voice of a somebody who studies politics here, how could what's going on now with the death of Antonin Scalia and the battle over whether or not to replace him now or later, how could that affect the presidential race?
Well, in I think the primary regard, it could possibly embolden the base. Come election day, whoever the nominees are, their first primary concern is going to be to paper over whatever bad feelings are caused on their way to the convention and to make sure that the party loyal, the loyal party base shows up on election day. And with a Supreme Court justice in the offing with whatever sense of outrage might be attached to what the Senate does, that could drive up participation.
Do you think that what Senate Republicans are doing is a risky strategy, or is it exactly what you expected they would do?
It is what I expected they would do, but it is also potentially risky. I mean, it certainly is going to play well, I think, with the most likely Republican voters and also with the leading candidates in the Republican race. But there's a couple of questions attached to at least Mitch McConnell's position. His argument is that this is so important that the American people should have a voice in the selection of the new justice. And the first question that raises is why voters in 2012 don't get that option. You know, they voted for a very particular candidate for president in a majority he won. This is part of his job. Certainly the Senate would be well within its rights to hold hearings and oppose whatever nominee the president sends to them. But to refuse to have a hearing or even a meeting is really taking things to a new level of obstruction and animosity. And that might play poorly, especially since the latest Pew poll suggests that a majority of the American people think that hearings should occur.
Yeah, and not only do the people speak in 2012, I would also add the people spoke in 1787 when they wrote the Constitution. I mean, they could have said the president has, you know, in the first 2 years or 3 years of his or her term gets to appoint somebody, and after that, you have to wait till the next election, and they didn't. So I think the argument that the people get to make a choice is kind of absurd. And the other piece of that is, obviously Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are trying to make the Supreme Court a highly salient issue, and maybe it'll become one. But if you look historically, people typically don't care all that much. You know, if you look at previous elections when people have studied, you know, what are important issues for you? I think the Supreme Court has been, you know, way down the line, like 0.5% people are interested in it. If you look at studies about political ignorance, very few Americans can name any justice in the Supreme Court. So I'm not sure how much this election, even today, can really be a referendum on the direction of the Supreme Court.
If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, though, does that, and Ron, I'll put this to you, does that change that dynamic because women's rights might be one of the things that come before the Supreme Court in a very, in the very near future, and we're looking at the balance of the Supreme Court, and we're looking at a potential candidate who's a woman. Ron?
She could certainly try to do that. I expect that she would try to do that. I think that your guests are probably correct, that the president is probably going to nominate someone who isn't a left Scalia, you know, somebody who already has been approved by the Senate for other positions and who can be seen as, you know, a respectful constitutional authority of some kind, and that would be something that a Clinton campaign would try to build on, the idea that the Republicans have gone much, much too far in obstructing the basic business of American government.
So I just responding to Dimitri's comment, he's right that voters don't put the Supreme Court as among their most salient concerns, but they do put the things the Supreme Court decides upon as their most salient concerns. I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't have a firm opinion on abortion, and very few who don't have a firm opinion on affirmative action, plus many other things. So I think the Republicans will be savvy about that, saying, you know, if we allow a Democratic nominee to go forward, you're going to, suddenly have, you know, abortion in your local provider or something like that. Mm-hmm. What I see is not unexpected but disappointing about the events of yesterday with what the Republican Senate said is that it's a new step in politicizing this third branch of government. We already have a completely politicized, almost dysfunctional legislative branch. We have an executive branch that almost by definition is political because only one person is in that. You're either a Democrat, a Republican, or some other party if we ever had one. But the judiciary has always stood as this third branch that is outside of politics to the extent that it can, even though it decides on very political kinds of things. I actually think Scalia undermined that partly. But so now to have this fight in an election year so long before Obama steps down and to be so blatantly political about it, I think is another dangerous step towards the really nasty political culture that we've seen develop in the United States.
Ron, if you could, I'm going to ask you to stay with us just a little bit longer. We're going to go to a call. We're going to go to Bobby in Freiburg. Hi, Bobby. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. My question is, regardless of who the appointee is there no repercussion legally or otherwise? I know setting precedents, that's one thing. But to not go forward with at least a hearing.
Bobby, do you mean are there any repercussions other than to not get possibly getting reelected?
To the Senate, you know, yeah, exactly. Is there anything built in to say this is a procedure that we follow, and are there no repercussions for someone or a group that just refuses?
Okay, we got your question. Dimitri.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who teaches constitutional law, I wish I could say there are answers to these kinds of questions. But, you know, this is one of these provisions, issues that's kind of left to the political process. I mean, the Constitution is clear. The president shall appoint, shall nominate, and the Senate advises and consents. And it doesn't say exactly what that looks like. And so it has largely historically been a political issue. And so the Senate can decide how and when to advise and to consent. And so the repercussions are political repercussions. If the Senate believes, hey, this is going against the wishes of our constituents, they'll change their views.
Ron, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you one more question. And Bobby, thank you for your question, which is, I have learned from you and other political scientists that the general election in a presidential race always comes down to just a few districts and a couple swing states. How does this play in those places?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think at this point, I'm sure there are people out there who would have a much more precise answer than this for you, but I'm not them. I think at this point, it's early to say. It depends on the way in which the parties and the way in which whoever winds up winning the nominations try to translate this issue into something that voters will resonate with. I mean, as you've heard, in general, voters don't have a lot of interest in the Supreme Court, but they are very interested in some of the big issue tickets on the docket. And it, to some degree, it comes down to how much energy the campaigns want to expend on trying to turn this into something that grabs a lot of attention in swing states.
All right. Well, Ron Schmidt, USM political science professor, thanks so much, as always, for coming on Main Calling.
Thank you.
And we're going to go back to the phones. We have George calling from Fayette. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Yes, I was kind of interested, and somebody on the panel said that making no choice is a choice itself, and what kind of a message that would send down the line to Congress anytime there was a major disagreement about a huge issue. They would not make any choices at all, and what the consequences for the Senate's operational, the way they operate their business when the parties change hands.
Joe, thoughts? Joe Reiser?
Sure. I mean, the Senate leadership has control of the agenda. They decide what issues to take up and when. At any given time, there's a million things that the legislature might want to take action on, and you know, they have to focus their energies, and they've decided in this case, this is not an issue they're going to take up. You know, I want to push back a little bit on the hypothesis that this is making our system more polarized and more partisan than it's been. You could imagine the Republicans taking the alternative tack of essentially trying to go the full Robert Bork on whomever the Democrats nominate. And as you may recall from that extremely bitter contest back in the 1980s, the man's character was impugned. His positions were horribly mischaracterized. He was really vilified in an incredibly personal way, you know, essentially for the political reason of keeping a staunch conservative off the court. You know, I think in this case for the Republicans to say, you know what, we're not going to do that to anybody. We're just going to wait and see who wins the presidential election. And I think that's actually more respectful.
Well, I guess I would say that keeping Bork off the court has not kept staunch conservatives off the court, if you look at Scalia and Thomas. And I think in some ways it's and, you know, the center of the court is not even. It's not at 0.00. It's certainly center right, because the right part, the conservative wing of the court, does have some people on the fairly extreme end of it, or did until a week and a half ago, whereas the other side, you know, are more center leftists, if you even want to call them that. So, yeah, so I guess I would say, even though I think almost everybody agrees that what happened to Bork was a low point, the political legacy of that perhaps was more about one individual than any particular ideology. I would also just add to the last caller's question, when he said, what happens if no choice is made? I think we should just also clarify what happens on the court. I think there's some misunderstanding that that if the court is not fully stacked, that it doesn't move forward. That's absolutely not right. It does move forward with 8 members, even with 7 in somewhere. Justice Kagan is not participating, recusing herself. And that has a couple of repercussions or meanings. One is that things could come out 4-4, making it, which means that the lower court's decision stands. That favors the conservatives in some cases, such as the Texas abortion law. It favors more leftist ones, like the union case that's coming up, on others. And also, there we expect that there will be cases that are decided 5-3, 8-0, and so forth. So it puts us into more dangerous territory, but it doesn't mean that the work of the court has to end.
George, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Tyler, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding the more procedural aspect in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, as majority leader, said he's not going to be holding any votes on any potential nominees. And I'm wondering, how much pressure would it take for him to relent on that promise? Can a majority leader just unilaterally say, we're never having a vote on something? Is he the one who decides to bring it to the calendar? Or if enough Republicans defect, could they force him to hold a vote?
Well, it ultimately ends up being a political battle. You know, if he feels like he has no support from his party, then I think he'd feel the pressure to change his mind. And so, as we were talking about earlier, you know, what are the sorts of things to raise that pressure? Well, if you know, the senators see, hey, in our district or in our state, this is playing really poorly and I'm going to lose my seat, they'll be able to put pressure on him. So ultimately, you know, Mitch McConnell, while he's sort of the face of the party, he still represents others in the party as well. And so you can imagine scenarios where if they get a sense that, hey, this is not playing well and this is going to cost us this election and future elections, they can put the pressure in and sort of, you know, force his hand.
Tyler, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. We do have to take another break. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the University of Maine School of Law. Located in Portland, committed to justice and leadership in a changing world, mainelaw.maine.edu. We know this is radio, but we have it on good advice that some of you have been watching Downton Abbey on Maine Public Television. Be aware that the very final episode of Downton Abbey will be next weekend on Sunday, March 6th. PBS is not offering the final episode this weekend so as not to conflict with the Oscars. This weekend, Maine Public Television will be broadcasting high school basketball. We will, however, have the Downton Abbey repeats 9 this Thursday evening and at 7:30 this Sunday. You can see our listings online for complete updated schedule information for Downton Abbey, Doc Martin, Mercy Street, and high school basketball. Again, the final Downton Abbey episode is Sunday, March 6th. And we invite you to join us after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for World Affairs, a discussion on the global effects of globalization. That's World Affairs coming up after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Supreme Court in the absence of Justice Antonin Scalia. With me in the studio, Jeannie Hay, who is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England. Dimitri Bam, a professor at the University of Maine School of Law. And joining us on the line from Colby College, Joseph Reisert, Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Newbold. I'm astonished that the media, MPBN included, is reluctant to say what is really going on. It's racism, pure and unabashed. There has been an effort to delegitimize President Obama since he was elected. Joe Reisert, do you think what's going on right now in terms of the Supreme Court is racism?
No, and here's why. If the shoes were all on the other feet, so in other words, Mitt Romney is president and Harry Reid is Senate Majority Leader, the same thing would be playing out in exactly the same way. And how do we know that's true? Because we have Joe Biden on tape in 1992 saying when George H.W. Bush was president that now that we're near the end of his term, he shouldn't get to appoint anybody to the Supreme Court. And we have Chuck Schumer on tape in 2007 saying pretty much the same thing about George W. Bush. I mean, the political logic of this is just so clear to strong partisans that I think this kind of impasse is really not at all surprising.
All right. We have an email from Frank. The Senate's refusal to hold hearings will affect almost two complete terms of the court's deliberations. All of the undecided cases this term, including those that Scalia heard arguments for but did not survive to participate in opinion writing, will be decided by only eight justices. In the next term, from October 2016 through June of 2017, will also be heard for the most part by an eight-justice court. Assuming a Republican or Democratic president either will submit a name in late January or early May, the new justice will be sworn in. In late January, early May is the earliest a new justice will be sworn in. Thus, sentence obstinance will affect almost two complete terms. Is he right, Dimitri?
That's right. That's a great point. So if you hold off on having any hearings, the new president gets into office on January 20th under the 20th Amendment. Even if the president has a name in mind and rushes the process, you've got two terms of split cases, which could be problematic. You know, the court sets out the law for lower courts. It's supposed to establish precedent for lawyers and judges. And so that having 4-4 splits in cases where there are sort of big circuit splits, big issues going on, potentially a problem. Of course, the court might hold off on cases, so not to decide them 4-4. They can try to put off a case for another year. So obviously Justice Roberts cares a great deal about the court's legacy. And so I think he will do what he can not to create this appearance that what's going on in the Senate or the sort of political rancor is really hurting the court. But, of course, if it's 2 years, it's hard to do.
All right. We're going to go to Linda calling from Southwest Harbor. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having the discussion. The caller previous to the one just called in nailed it when he said, we have on tape Joe Biden, something Joe Biden said and some other Democrat. I'd like to bring to the panel's discussion is we also have on tape Mitch McConnell said in 2008, now that Obama is president, our job is to obstruct anything that he proposes. And indeed they have. And all the really wonderful writers that are writing in contemporary times have gone down in the history books as saying this has been the most racist effort to discredit a wonderful person and what he supports. And if I may say also, I'd like the panel to address the issue of anybody on the panel is either gay or has had an abortion or is black, has had the experience of being discriminated against, and how much these issues are so important in the 21st century. Thank you very much for having this. discussion, but Mitch McConnell is the obstructionist party, and we should have an end to it.
Thanks,
Linda. Lucky you being in beautiful Southwest Harbor. I would say, so you brought up a lot of things. First, just to take up the Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell thing, and also responding to Joe's comment earlier. It's true what the caller just said, that when Obama was elected, Mitch McConnell came out and said very publicly that job one is to not get President Obama reelected. That was, you know, arguably the single most partisan declaration coming out of a congressional leader. I don't know. There are plenty of them, so it would be among the top. So the caller's right about that. Now, the question is whether Joe Biden, Chuck Schumer, and others would act in a similarly partisan way. Probably, you know, as much as I'd like to think not, we could very well be in the same situation. I'd make two points about that. One is that doesn't make it right. And two is the Biden proclamation that the Senate leaders on the Republican side used yesterday was in a different context. I know it's easy to say, oh, well, that was taken out of context. There was no vacancy on the court. Joe Biden was speaking in June, I believe, of 1992, looking at the possibility of George H.W. Bush losing reelection and a Democrat coming in. And there was talk at the time of a Republican appointee or a conservative justice stepping down right then for the express purpose of allowing George H.W. Bush to make a nomination before a Democratic elected president, in this case Bill Clinton, could come in and fill that seat. Now, none of that ever happened, but that was the context that Biden was speaking about. And then just quickly on the race question, well, I'll ask Jennifer if you want me to talk about that, because I think that actually is an important segue to Justice Scalia. But
sure.
Okay, so whether or not the rancor and the vitriol directed at President Obama over the last 8 years is rooted in racism or not, there's no question that it has been really ugly. Now, it was ugly for the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration and for the 8 years of the Bill Clinton administration. But certainly there's, you know, in the netherworld of the Internet, some hideous racism directed at President Obama, and some hideous sexism directed at Hillary Clinton, Carly Fiorina, and others. Where I think this connects with Scalia is in some comments that he actually made very recently connected to the affirmative action case in Texas, where, and this is a man who is lauded for his brilliance, his gift of gab, the prose of his speech and writings. And he said, he got up and he said, well, you know, I know a lot of black people don't really like it at the best schools. And they feel much more comfortable at schools with lower standards. And so that's one of the reasons that affirmative action is bad. I mean, that to me is racist. I can't call it anything else. And, you know, all of us on this panel are teachers in universities, and we know that, you know, students who struggle in college are many, and it's not by race. So I just think, you know, unfortunately, there is a racial element to this, and Scalia, shortly before he died, and I think really hurting his legacy, brought it up in a very ugly way.
All right, we're going to head to Rick in Lincolnville. Hi, Rick, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm a retired attorney, and I just wanted to start by saying I once had, I guess, the experience of being in class with Professor Scalia, and he was brilliant.
Rick, we can barely hear you. Is there any way you can bring your phone closer to your mouth?
Yes. I had Professor Scalia once, and he was brilliant, but also acerbic and possibly cynical. And I had two questions. One is, can one of the panelists actually help us with the wording of Article 2 as to what the president ought to be doing or can be doing right now? And secondly, can one of the panelists comment on what appears to be the position that the conservatives deserve to have a replacement who is equally conservative, as though it's a matter of right?
All right. I'm going to take that one, send this one up to Joe Reisert at Colby.
All right, I'm going to do this by memory. Unfortunately, I don't have the text out in front of me. But the president shall, with the advice and consent of the Senate, appoint, is, I believe, how the language goes. So it's pretty clear that the president has the right, arguably the duty, to make a nomination. And I'm sure he will. And then the Senate, which has its own process of advising and consenting, is also constitutionally empowered to set its own procedures for its own internal deliberations. And if they decide that their best way to deliberate is to not hold hearings and wait it out, then that's an unreviewable choice assigned to them by the Constitution. As to the idea that the Republicans are entitled to somebody as conservative as Scalia, you can understand maybe why some conservative partisan would advocate such a view, but it really has no constitutional support, and really, except as a kind of election slogan to gin up the conservative base, I can't see what value it would have. It would be interesting to get Senator McConnell's take on whether he would agree to let a hearing go forward in the unlikely event of a split election outcome. I mean, usually if a party wins the presidency, they also win the Senate. But in the unlikely case that the Republicans held the Senate with a Democratic presidency, it seems like they'd be – their obstruction at that point would, I think, become untenable. But then who knows?
Yeah, I agree with Joe as well here. So, you know, in terms of what the Constitution says, he's got the language almost exactly right. And the president has an obligation. It says shall nominate. Doesn't say much about what Congress can do and think about. Seems to give Senate discretion as far as, you know, the factors it considers relevant, which is why we're talking about history and about what Democrats have done, because all of those sort of factors seem to be part of our constitutional analysis.
All right, we're going to go to Ellen, who's calling from Kennebunk. Ellen, I think you have a question that's been raised a couple of times, not today, but out there on the Internet. Go ahead.
Yes. Could there be a recess appointment by President Obama?
Dimitri.
Well, it's happened before. You know, President Eisenhower made a number of recess appointments. I think these days it's hard. I think if he wanted to do it, his chance might have already passed. And basically, he had a case a couple of years ago where the court said, as long as Senate says we're in session, we're not in recess, they're not in recess. And so the Senate essentially controls when they go in recess. And what they've done is they've held these pro forma sessions where even if they're gone from D.C., somebody shows up, gavels in, gavels out every 3 days, and the court has said that's not a recess. So it's a theoretically possible tool. He can try to do it, but it's unlikely to succeed.
All right, Ellen, thanks for that question. We have an email from Chuck on the GOP theory that voters should have a voice and the nomination should be delayed. Shouldn't Misters Trump, Cruz, and Rubio be telling us who they would intend to nominate now? Isn't it a strategic mistake to put these candidates in this position? Probably a question for Ron Schmidt, but I have a feeling the opposite is true, that every time you say who you're going to nominate, you invite scrutiny
yeah,
and criticism.
I would predict that they would be getting that question from journalists and maybe at debates on a daily basis, and they will find increasingly creative ways to avoid it.
I think the answer for them is somebody in the mold of Justice Scalia.
That's what they'll say over and over again. Well, we have just about a minute left, and Joe, I'll send this up to you. What are your students talking about? What is their take on this situation?
Well, I think they're, like many of the callers we've heard, frustrated that the Senate won't be acting. Of course, to be fair, most of my students are strong Democratic partisans, and so it's not surprising that they view it that way. I mean, there are a few conservative students I've spoken to, and they're sort of sympathetic to the GOP position. And I guess that shows you that, you know, the partisan divide on this thing runs very deep.
Okay, so breaking along party lines among students in Colby, what about law school students?
Well, yeah, we were talking about some of the same issues that we've talked about here. So what happens to the cases that are at the court now? You know, we've talked a lot about abortion, affirmative action, about free speech. And so some cases where we thought we'd have a close 5-4 decision, now we're going to have a 4-4 split. What are the implications of that, and what happens going forward?
All right. And Jeannie, what about you? What are you hearing at UNE?
Similar stuff about how you know, that this is sad that we're so gridlocked that we can't move forward when there's an opening on the court. And also just, I think, talking about Scalia's legacy, of course, in the wake of the man dying, there's a lot of conversation about, oh, he was funny, he was smart, he was charming. But I think a second look really reminds us to be aware of the impact that he had, you know, on personal gun rights, on abortion rights, on affirmative action, on Citizens United, and many other things. You know, so many of them are saying, you know, this gives us an opportunity to move things in the other direction.
Well, thank you guys for a really great conversation. Jeannie Hay is University of New England's Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Dimitri Bam is a professor at the University of Maine School of Law. And Joseph Reisert is Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law at Colby College. John Keimel ran the board today. Cindy Hahn took your calls and produced today's program. And we had help from Emma Larson Whitaker and Sydney Campbell. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, join Keith Shortall for a conversation about the dangers of toxic levels of lead in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.